generous. Thank you, Chancellor. Marvelous, lovely, warm people. I just can't get over this group. This is something else. I must say, you are very, very, well, you're kind to each other. You don't beat up on each other or anything. Or you don't heckle. It's really super. Well, you will find that I love to walk around as I talk, but I will be very good and not walk around. I will stand right here by the microphone because it's very disconcerting for people like me who have a hearing problem, and I think there may be a couple of others around who might, that you stay near the microphone. So when I don't stay near the microphone, you just point back to the microphone and now remember. Okay. I usually love to walk around.
You can hold it if you want.
Oh, I could, couldn't I?
It doesn't go very far.
It doesn't go very far.
You can't walk too little.
No, but I could walk. I could do this. Cool. Right. Oh, much, much. Ah. This is clearly the bright side of young. Yes, there's that wonderful story where you're standing in front of a classroom and there are students in the classroom and they can work to get the lecturer to always stand on the left side. You know that trick? You smile sweetly whenever I'm over there, but you frown when I'm over here, and I'll soon be standing over there. You know that trick. Okay. Lovely folks. Well, let me start by telling you a tiny bit about, very, very quickly, about what research I am doing and how that is relevant, perhaps, to CCL. My first experience with climate research was about 20 years ago when I spent a year at the Climatic Research Unit. The Climatic Research Unit is that place in East Anglia where Phil Jones and many other excellent climate scientists, some of the world's best climate scientists, in my view, work together and have done so for now 40 years at an organization that works specifically and has been publishing enormously on climate change. That group very kindly let me come and spend a year with them, and then I spent the next 14 years in the summers doing research with that group. That group turns out to be exactly the same group, it turns out, that indeed was the source of ClimateGate. Now, you don't remember ClimateGate, but about 5 years ago, emails were stolen. I was very proud. My emails were stolen. It was very exciting to have my emails stolen. Too bad I didn't say anything interesting in my emails, but it would have been good. On the other hand, as you know, after 10 years of being badgered by the climate deniers, the Climatic Research Unit folks began to sort of get a little uppity about always handing out all of their research to the climate research folks, to the climate deniers, and they began to say, well, grumble, grumble, do we really have to turn over all our data? And the answer, of course, is yes, you do. But it became annoying, and so among themselves, in emails, they would write back and forth and say, do we really have to give them all this stuff that they're asking for time after time after time? And the answer, of course, is yes. But that was picked up then by the deniers as evidence that there was a plot against them as climate deniers that all this stuff about climate was really a fake. Well, that fortunately went away, there was an investigation, several investigations into the ClimateGate business, and it was determined that there was no ulterior motive at all on their part. But as I say, I was very pleased to have my email stolen. Okay, what I'd like to do today is to just leave a couple of ideas in your mind. I don't want to overwhelm you with stuff, because there is lots of stuff out there in climate science. This is a picture that shows the Thames River in 1683, and for 7 weeks they were able to hold a fair on that river. It turns out in the 20th century and since, the Thames River has never frozen, so there is something different going on in the world. Beep! That's my signal to Rick. Ha-ha! Encyclical, wonderful things by the Pope. You've read them, I've read them. Let's go on. Beep! Right. No, they're magnificent. Yes, but I let's skip over them. Right, skipping over the Pope is really heretical. But I've just done it. There you go. So there we go. Let me just read the last one. It says, today we have to realize that a true ecological approach always becomes a social approach. It must integrate questions of justice in debates on the environment, so as to hear both the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor. That is essential, and that is essential to your message as well. And that comes through in direct and indirect ways from all the things I heard this morning from Dick Smith and Jim. Jim, your last name is? Thank you. Great. So let's go on. Wonderful things. Okay, my conclusion, that we are obliged to move away from our non-sustainable and climate-damaging fossil fuel use as quickly as possible, and we're clever enough to figure out how to do that, and that's completely consistent with your points of view, the CCL folks. There are indeed things happening that I'd like to spend just a minute on, and they have to do with this idea of hot drought. There are cool droughts and there are hot droughts. And one of the things that's difficult about the present situation in California is that indeed there is no rain. It's not just that there's no rain, it's the fact that there is no rain in a hot environment. That hot environment is coming from something that you and I know quite well, called climate change. So that says that hot droughts are indeed likely to occur much more often. It turns out that if you go back in the record 1,000 years, you will find times in California's history when there were as much as 200 years of drought. 200 years in a row. Not without rain, but with very little rain. But it turns out those droughts were what are called cool droughts. They were done in a time when the total Earth's temperature was a bit lower, and so much less serious. So hot drought turns out to be really serious. Okay, so what is my research? In a nutshell, my research turns out to be the connection between climate change and soil moisture. Now, I just noticed this excitement on your face when I said soil moisture. Oh, yes! Soil moisture, that's what I always wanted to talk about. There is a connection. There is a connection. Think about this. You and I don't have an ocean. The folks with an ocean are very lucky because the ocean moderates their temperature. Does it not? We don't have an ocean here. Aha. But we have something else which is at least as good, and that is soil moisture. It turns out when the sun's energy comes in, there are only two things the sun's energy basically does. The sun's energy comes in, and either it heats the atmosphere from the ground through advection or the process of conduction and convection, or it evaporates water. Let me say that again. Sun's energy comes in and does one of two things. Either it eventually heats the atmosphere, that's called global warming, if you will, or it evaporates water. Ooh. Now, about 80% or 90% of the sun's energy actually evaporates water. It doesn't heat the atmosphere. Ooh. All right. So what happens if I take away soil moisture, do you suppose? Ooh. That means that other 80%, which is evaporating water, suddenly is heating the atmosphere. And you have what is called a desert. You and I know about deserts. They're very hot, and the extreme temperatures in deserts are enormous. So the idea of the coupling between soil moisture and extreme temperatures is very direct. My area of study is looking at extremes, and extremes then must be correct in climate models. Okay, enough said about what I do. Beep, let's go on. Okay, climate change underway. Beep, next, let's just write. All right, 2014, hottest year on record. Beep. 2015, even hotter than 2014, not by a tiny amount, but by an enormous amount. So what the heck is going on? Well, it's called climate change, and it is something which, if you look at this little plot here, which is just a summary of what's going on for all the January through August for the last 120 years, what you will see is there's an increase. This is both land and ocean temperatures. What you see is there's an increase. And if I had to draw a straight line through that, you could do the same, and it would be pretty easy to do. You can see that there is, without too much difficulty, something that would correspond to a line rising. And here is 2015 so far, and here is 2014, and you can see that 1998 back here was a hot year. That was an El Nino year, as you recall. And then if you take away those last 2 years, look what happens. You take away the last 2 years, and suddenly you see something that looks like a hiatus. A hiatus is a fancy word for something that looks like stability, maybe, something which is rising and then beginning to plateau. Suddenly, 2014-2015 is putting a very quick end to that point of view. You can see immediately that there is an increase in temperature, and that increase, unfortunately, is continuing to rise. Beep. Okay, so, and if I go back over the last 1,000 years, you can look to see whether this is a special event or not, and the answer is, this is where we are. I guess I should use my little pointer, shouldn't I? Did I buy it? I ate it. Oh, I don't have a little pointer, do I? Well, that's all right. I point here. Right there is 2000, and 2015 is way up here, lovely folks. And what you notice is that it's not only hotter than the mini ice age, which we saw back here when indeed the Thames River was freezing, but it actually turns out to be considerably hotter than the medieval warm period. Oh, you're super.
Okay.
Oh. Yes, and if no doubt I'll push the wrong one and then I'll get in trouble. Right, let's see if I can do. Ah, good, okay. So, you know that, and that's what's going on, so the last 1,000 years are interesting. Beep! Poor Rick. Okay, this is an important piece of the discussion. That turns out to be energy from the sun, and I'm going to spend just a minute talking about climate change and global warming because that's what physicists do. And what I'd like to do is to convince you that infrared radiation has a lot to do with your life and a lot to do with the lives of others. And I have here my little infrared gun, which I will pull out. This is not a weapon, I promise. Okay. It looks like a weapon, and I hate it, but there you go. Okay. This is also an Ebola gun, and does all sorts of good things. It tells whether you're sick. Let me see. I try it out on you. No, you're not sick. Okay, you're right. You're fine. It gives you an instantaneous measurement of temperature. So right now, the temperature on the ceiling is 83. Temperature down here is 78. Strange. Are you surprised? No, not surprised. Should be hotter up there, of course. Question, lovely folks, what happens if I actually take the temperature of the sky right now? Right now, just point it upward and take a temperature of the sky. What would I get? Your understanding of climate change depends very much on your answer. Ooh. Let's look into it just a tiny bit, because it is interesting. Your first thought might be, well, if I take an infrared picture of the sky, and I really believe that climate change is taking place, that is, that the sky is reabsorbing all our infrared radiation and radiating it back down again, then indeed it should be pretty hot. All right, just take a picture. It's coming down, all that infrared radiation coming back down again from the sky. That's the blanket we talk about. So if I point it upward, it should be pretty high. Well, it is. It is pretty hot. It actually turns out to be only about minus 150 degrees F, which turns out to be something. Help me, lovely folks. That's roughly minus 70 degrees C. So is that cold? No, that's not very cold. It turns out if I go to outer space, I'll find a much, much colder temperature. So actually, the sky right now is re-radiating infrared back down again, and that's really important because that's exactly what's going on. So here's a picture. This is a picture of the visible light over here. This is the stuff which you and I know from, the fact that we can see things, ultraviolet over here, and lots of infrared radiation coming from over here, which we usually just call heat energy. Now, in principle, I can space this forward. Let's see if I can do it. Oh, I can't. Well, okay, if you could, yes. Okay, that's Cynthia in my office with an infrared photograph, and that just says what we said before, so we can go on. Okay, this is important. This is a piece of information about the science, and it's something you can carry away. And it has to do with an understanding of climate as due to two windows. There, this funny bump over here is just the radiation coming from the sun. So this stuff here is the radiation from the sun. There's the ultraviolet. There's the visible. There's the infrared over there. This is looking at wavelength over this direction. And this is the bump that comes from radiation that you and I are producing and trying to get back out into outer space. So there are two bumps. There's the sun's bump, short wavelength radiation, and there's the long bump. That's in the infrared, and that's what you and I are emitting, and that's why when I take a picture of you with an infrared camera, you show up so beautifully. Okay? You're emitting infrared radiation. If you don't believe it, put your hand next to your face, and you will feel suddenly, without touching, get really close, and you can feel already, instantaneously, a heat exchange between your face and your hands. That's not due to convection or conduction. That's actually due to the fact that your hand is radiating infrared radiation. Okay? Cool. Okay, so this is the bump coming in. This is the heating business. So the sun's light comes in, it heats the ground, and then the ground has to re-radiate that energy back out into space. And the difficulty is that one of those windows is open and the other is partially closed. Here's the open window. This is the easy piece. The open window over here is the part that just says you can see the sun when you look up at the atmosphere. This second band across here is just what the atmosphere does to radiation. And you can see that visible radiation goes right through the atmosphere with no difficulty at all. Okay, ultraviolet radiation over here is basically absorbed by the atmosphere, not a danger very much. On the other hand, here is the little window over here that is where the radiation actually escapes and goes back out into outer space. And if you close that window, lovely folks, you're in trouble. I'm in trouble. We're in trouble. And that's what we're doing. Okay, we're closing the infrared window. We're closing the free passage of infrared light back out, which you know. Okay, and if I look at the detailed bumps, I will find that this is the shoulder, which is due mainly to nitrous oxides and some of the methane gases, and then there's ozone and oxygen in the middle, and then over here is the famous CO2 boundary, which is creeping in on us as we increase the amount of CO2. So any of those greenhouse gases can close the window. Beep. Okay, so that's in a nutshell, lovely folks, if anyone ever asks you about climate change, that's it. What's happening is that you're having more radiation coming in through the visible window that can't get back out again because the infrared window, unfortunately, is closing. Okay? Fine. All right, so this is CO2. It's rising. It's now well above 400 parts per million, typically in May. I won't go through the business of explaining why it is it goes through this cyclical peak. You and I know that in the summer, for example, the trees are very kindly absorbing CO2, and in the winter, they are actually exuding CO2, giving off CO2 as you are, and so in the winter, you get a buildup of CO2, and in the summer, you get a drawdown of CO2, and we could talk about southern, northern hemispheres, but let's skip that. Beep. Okay, so there it is. There's CO2 over the last 1,000 years, 1,200 years, and you can see that something funny is going on. In fact, we're doing that uncontrolled experiment. There we are at 399. It actually went up to 403. This summer, it's back down to 399 because all summer long, we've been taking CO2 out of the atmosphere because of those crazy trees outside. And what you see then is that you and I, as human beings, are doing something rather dramatic. There's the Industrial Revolution right about there. Well, actually back here, when it really gets going, you start burning lots of carbon, then things go very quickly. Okay, so that's where we are. That's good old carbon dioxide in growing. And this says the sources of CO2, which are mainly fossil fuel burning and land change, and then it goes into roughly half to the atmosphere, half to the land, a quarter to the land, and a quarter to the oceans. I think if you go ahead and click that thing about three more times, you'll get a bunch of circles. Okay. Half to the atmosphere, a quarter to the land, and a quarter to the oceans. That's the acidification part which we worry about. Okay, this is, of course, the piece which has to do with climate science. Okay, beep. Fine. And if you look indeed to see how we're doing as a human race in reducing our total CO2 output, the little red dot here shows that we are very much on the path which is called the business as usual path. This is back in 2007 when the IPCC decided to produce such a plot. Then ever since, they've been plotting the amount of carbon we produce to see whether we might hopefully have turned the corner and begun reducing our CO2 use, and the answer is no. Beep. Okay, so there's one other piece to this puzzle which has to do with energy. And as a person who's been talking about energy for the last 30 years, let me tell you just a tiny bit. Beep. Let's take a look at this. This is the most boring table in the world, but it's really important for one reason. And the reason is it's going to convince you of one detail, which you may know. And that is that if you look at all the fossil fuels that we have available in our resources in the world, it's a very large number. That number is sometimes estimated to be as large as 200 Q or larger, maybe 400 Q, and a Q is a quintillion, it turns out, BTUs, so we don't care about that, but Q is a very large number of energy, a very large amount of energy, and to give you a scale, we, as human beings on the Earth, use about half a Q a year. Okay. If I look then to see how much of that is in the form of coal, I find out that roughly 200 Q is coal, and oil about 10 Q, and natural gas about 10 Q. So the only point I make from this transparency is this. and that is that there's a magic bell up here which I could ring, and you ring it when I get close to time. Give me 5 minutes, okay, at the end, okay? So the difficulty is this. The vast majority of fossil fuels turns out coal. The reason I mentioned is that oil and gas will, in the next few years, next several years, tens of years perhaps, expire. That's too bad, but that's the way it is, okay? That's actually good in some levels. So if we were climate scientists and it turns out that there was a certain amount of oil, a certain amount of gas, a certain amount of coal, and they were all small, we could shrug our shoulders and say, well, we'll simply run out of them, in which case we don't have to worry. Unfortunately, there is this huge 800-pound gorilla which is staring us in the face, which is this enormous amount of coal in the world which is available and turns out to be the dirtiest of the fuels. Okay, so keeping that in mind, you have one piece of information, beep, which is that coal turns out to be far larger than the others. I'm sorry, yes, you go down, you can go click, click, click. It's also true to notice that if you think about fracking as our great new savior, fracking is an interesting source of energy. But the estimated amount of fracking gas available in the United States, let's take a look. Oh, in the United States, it turns out to be 0.54 cubed. Oh. So when someone says to you, well, all we need to do is just depend on fracking, the answer is probably not. Probably not. Not at a half a cube a year, and there's only 0.54 cubed of total resource available. Well, let's go on. Beep. Okay, this is, in a nutshell, going to prepare you for one other piece of information, and that is the total amount of energy we have to use before we exceed the 2-degree limit is extremely small. It turns out that number is about 35 Q. We have 200 Q available, and so the vast majority of that 200 Q is never going to get used. It must stay in the ground. It must stay in the ground. There is a recent publication, beep, the recent publication, all right, so we have science done, consequences are next, and then action. Okay, beep. Fine. The sea level rise is an interesting discussion. The sea level is rising. The plot there shows that increase over the period from 1994 up to 2008. That continues on upward at a fairly constant rate. Beep. All sorts of consequences. There is one piece of that which is an interesting puzzle, and that is called this business of isostatic uplift. And let me just tell you a word about that because it's kind of an interesting detail. It turns out that if you load all of Canada down with 2 miles of ice, this is North America, this is Canada, and down here is U.S., and there's Mexico right here. So Mexico, U.S., and Canada. Now what nature has done is to put 2 miles of ice, 3 kilometers of ice, here on Canada 20,000 years ago. So that end goes down. Well, it turns out that this whole continent is floating in a lithographic, in a lithospheric underpinning, and so as you push down here, the whole continent tips up like that. Interesting, okay? As the ice melts, as it has now done, you get something which is called isostatic uplift. That is, all of Canada is rising. Ice goes away, it says, oh, I rather like this, and the whole of Canada is rising. Ooh. Well, if Canada is rising, that's great. That's fine for the Canadians. But what about the rest of us? Oh dear, we're sinking. We are sinking. We're at the bottom end of that process. You should call it isostatic sinking, I guess. We were talking about that at breakfast. But if we're sinking, then there is another problem that has to do with, indeed, this whole business of sea level rise. And that is, not only is the sea level rising, but the whole of the U.S. is actually going down. This is not good. This is definitely not good. So you have a problem that says that then if you look at the net result, places on the East Coast, for example, are experiencing enormous sea level difficulties because of this rapid rise. Beep. Okay, that just explains what I said. Beep. Lots of good physics there. Okay, there is one other piece to this. I really wanted to press the hell out of you before I give you any encouragement. So this is one other depressing slide. And then we can talk about all the exciting things going on. One other depressing piece is the business that has to do with Antarctica and the melting of ice in Antarctica. And you have read various tales of that story, perhaps, but let me just fill you in with the details that are coming from this last year, or the last 6 months, even the last few months. It turns out there are a number of glaciers in the Admonson Sea, which is shown here, is just a piece of the... I'm not paying attention here. Here we go. Right over here is Antarctica. There is Antarctica shown from the South Pole, and that little blown-up piece there is this piece of Antarctica right here. There's the Admonson Sea right there, and this is the famous Thwaites Glacier, which is sitting right there. The Thwaites Glacier is actually feeding into the Admonson Sea as it melts. Not surprising. Glaciers are melting, and indeed glaciers in Antarctica, where it's supposed to be not melting, are indeed melting quite rapidly. Beep. Okay, so what's going on? Well, it turns out that usually a glacier, when it comes down into the ocean, reaches a point where it runs against the ground and it stops flowing. However, if it turns out that the water underneath is warm enough to melt away the ice from underneath, then there is no mechanism to stop the ice from flowing. And then you get something which is beyond the tipping point, and that is a point where you cannot change the flow of the glacier. That's not good. Again, if I point out, I am depressing you with, I can see it in your face. All right, there we go. Anyway, what's going on is you melt away the bottom piece here, the glacier then has no mechanism to stop it, and the result is that not only the Thwaites Glacier, but then all these other glaciers begin to rise, flow rapidly into the ocean. Right now, the Thwaites is moving at about 3 kilometers a year into the ocean. 3 kilometers a year doesn't sound very fast, but that's, well, it's getting up to turtle speed and faster. So it's enormously rapid. And the scary part for me as a climate scientist is that we already have basically lost control of the melting of that portion of Antarctica. Okay, beep, one more slide, and then I'm done with the depressing part. This is an article that came out just on the 11th of September this year. A group of scientists from the Netherlands published a paper which simply points out in great detail what happens if you do try to burn the fossil fuels that we have available. If you do that, then, as they point out, in a very careful study, you will simply lose the Antarctic ice. Now that will take place over a long period of time, but then that also has enormous consequences, not the least of which is that you increase the depths of the ocean by about 60 meters. 60 meters means that all of Cape Cod. I love Cape Cod, and we were talking about things I really love. Well, one of the things I really love, it turns out to be, are my ancestors and my relatives who live on Cape Cod, and they're gone. They're simply gone. They're out of commission. 58 meters, 180 feet of rise plus and some is enough to make any of us cry. Okay, so that takes care of all the major cities in the United States. So you don't want to go there. There are all sorts of reasons. Okay, enough. Right. Beep. Right. Beep. Right. That's a nice picture. Beep. One other detail, which has to do with the Midwest. This is a study which has been done by a group of scientists who are writing something which is called the Federal Advisory Committee Draft, a report put out in January of 2013. This simply shows an interesting trend of temperatures in the Midwest. And we are in the Midwest, and this includes Indiana and Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and two other states. There it is. There is the average rise in temperature. It's rising by something of the order of 1.5 degrees F, almost a degree C, every century-ish. Beep. The result of that is whatever it is, but here are the two crops that we use in Indiana and elsewhere in the Midwest to make to do most of our agriculture, corn and soybeans. And what you can see is that there is, unfortunately, a temperature sensitivity to temperature, there is a sensitivity of both of these crops to temperature rise. As the temperature rises, what you notice then is that both corn and soybeans decrease in productivity. So in a nutshell, folks, that means that we are growing toward a population of 9 billion people, and we are doing so in an environment where we are losing the capacity to raise the crops which support the people who live here. Fine. Beep. Okay. One comment from E.O. Wilson I cannot help but read to you. History now teaches a different lesson. The obliteration of nature is a dangerous strategy. For one thing, we have become a species specialized to eat seeds from four kinds of grasses: wheat, rice, corn, and millet. If these fail from disease or climate change, we too shall fail. Some 50,000 wild plant species, many of which face extinction, offer alternative food sources. If one insists on being thoroughly practical about the matter, allowing these and the rest of wild species to exist should be considered part of a portfolio of long-term investment. Even the most recalcitrant people must come to view conservation as simply prudence in the management of the Earth's natural economy. Yet few have begun to think that way at all. E.O. Wilson. Beep. Okay. Thoroughly depressed. All right, lovely folks. And there are all sorts of ways to... All right, now we can start on what turns out to be a much more positive note, and that turns out to be using the science to mitigate climate change. Human beings are enormously clever, and a whole bunch of you are sitting here in this room, and I am overwhelmed by your cleverness and the discussions that have been going on. So let me just tell you about a story. Here's a story about cleverness, and you are part of this story. Let's suppose that you are... I'm sorry to make all this bumpy sound. I think we can reduce that. Let's talk about a possible solution to an interesting problem from the point of view of science and technology. Many years ago, I was a student at MIT, and there was a new auditorium, well, almost new auditorium. It was actually put there in 1953, designed by a person whose name is E.O. Saarinen, who has done a number of things, including the St. Louis Arch and other lovely things. It turns out that Saarinen designed this building in such a way that it sits on three little points. It looks like an eggshell. It's a beautiful building. That's fine. Next door, they decided to put in an ice skating rink. Okay, so you have two buildings. You have this brand new auditorium at MIT, and next door you have an ice skating rink. Massachusetts is not the warmest place in the world, and so you have to heat the building. And the question is, how are you going to heat this building, this brand new auditorium, do you suppose? Think about the ice skating rink and think about heating the building, and already I can see the wheels clicking and click, click, click. The engineers are already there. The rest of us are sort of struggling to come along. How do you suppose they decided to solve that problem? Yeah. Jeff. Sure. They took the heat out of the ice to heat the building. It works beautifully. It's sometimes called cogeneration, but it's a brilliant idea. In 1953, it was a lovely idea. So it's a way that shows that you could use enormously less energy in the old days, indeed, by using your noggin, by using cleverness. There are other lovely stories that have to do with cleverness, one of which was good old Tom Jefferson. Tom Jefferson did the reverse process. He actually was able to keep ice from the winter and use it the following summer. And he did that, of course, by gathering ice from the local river. And others said, there's no way to have ice in the summer. You can't do that. And indeed, he did it with great success. University of Alabama has a building where they simply take the heat from the summer and store it for the following winter. Is that possible? Can you just do that? Maybe we do away with this so-called summer-winter problem by just doing this clever thing of just saving summer heat and using it the following winter. Could we do that and eliminate our fuel bills? Would that be a great boon to climate? It would indeed. All right, so there are all sorts of clever technical things you could do. How do they do that? Well, the way they do that is to actually take heat out of the building using air conditioning in the summer. They pipe it underground. The ground gets a little warmer in the winter. And then at the end of the summer, the ground is quite warm. They suck that back out and use it all winter long to heat the buildings. Is that clever? Yes, that's clever. Can we be clever? Yes, we can be technically clever, and technologically that's the kind of thing we are doing. Okay, beep, let's go on and talk about some other things. Soil, all sorts of wind, all sorts of good things happening. This is a resource for those who are interested in renewable energy. It turns out the folks at Purdue have just come out with their 2015 Indiana Renewable Energy Study, and if anybody's interested, I can certainly give you information about that. Beep. Okay, that IPCC summary, beep, we'll skip that. And the next one as well, all sorts of things that summarize the doleful state of situation. Beep. All right, let's talk about action. All right. That's where I am here and as a learner, and you are the experts, and I am deeply grateful to you. And I have learned more this morning from Dick Smith and others about how you do this than I have ever learned in my life before. So I give you full marks for that. Beep. First thing I notice is that there are three areas where CCL seems to be critical. One is in politics, one is in social justice, and the other is in economics. Now, I haven't heard a great deal of discussion about social justice, but that certainly is an issue which is extremely important to me. As a person in Bloomington, Indiana, I am working in an organization which is sometimes called HIPL, which is the Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light. We have a number of congregations, if you will, that get together around the state. And what we do is we simply have these boot camps where we talk with clergy, gathering, say, 20 clergy together in each of these boot camps, get them together to encourage them to actually make the connection between their religious faith and the idea of conserving the world they live in. That booklet that you handed out, indeed, on the tables when we came in illustrates beautifully that point of view. It turns out that in Indiana, which is a fairly conservative state, it is a really good idea to work with people through their religious organizations. That turns out to be a very powerful strategy of which we are taking full advantage. And in conversation with Madeline and others, I have picked up some ideas about how we might actually make that connection so that it is an effective one. That's the kind of thing. These are our group of folks who are part of this HIPL group. These are all young people. They're people who are high school kids who are doing the lobbying oftentimes with us and for us. So when we go to talk to our congressmen, we go with oftentimes some of the younger kids. And as you know, they are enormously effective in making those connections. Beep. Okay, so there is the politics. You know better than I love James Inhofe's comment about the great climate change is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. It's just amazing to me that continues. We talked about ClimateGate and my stolen emails, and then there are the other things that are happening, including the recent climate agreement between China and the U.S. Beep. This just shows the policy of statements made and what China has promised to do, and those are all marvelous things, it seems to be. Beep. Well, and that just came out of yesterday's paper, showing that indeed China is planning to do something that has to do with cap and trade. They need to be educated. We need to get in touch with the Chinese right away and tell them there's a better way. Right. Okay. Beep. This just reminds me of the social justice issues where sea level in Bangladesh is turning out to force people to have boats for their schools because of the flooding, and there is enormous consequences of that. And I'm sure there are people here who can talk to me, talk better than I. Madeline, I'm just about, I'm running out of time, I'm sure, and do I have how many more minutes? 5 minutes? Three? Seven?
You have
7 minutes left. Okay, good. Beep. Fine. It occurs to me from the social justice point of view, and here I go back to the comments made by our Pope Francis, and that is that many of the issues which are so strong and important to us as climate scientists are now spilling over into that realm of the impacts of climate change on the poor. And I really like the statement of Sally McFaig, who says the following. I listen carefully to this individual statement by her. I'm not sure I buy it all, but it's really good. The individualistic model is symbolized by the phrase life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the rights and desires of the individual are paramount. And then she has this other thing called an ecological model, which is in sharp contrast to that. She says, in sharp reversal, we do not control nature, but rely utterly on it. In this picture, human beings are products of nature and depend on it for our every breath and bit of food. And then the ecological model house rules, from her point of view, are one, take only your share, two, clean up after yourself, and three, keep the house in good repair for future occupants. So it seems to me that as climate scientists and certainly as human beings, that is our goal. That is certainly my goal from our point of view. So there is the other piece of this, which is not necessarily part of CCL, but what I'm hearing is consistent with CCL's mission, and that is the business of moving quickly to a business which is fair for everyone. And the lovely thing about CCL is that it also takes into account very specifically the role and the fate of the poor in the society, the poor in society. I should put this down. Okay, one more slide, and then I'm done. Then questions. Okay, the economic change, many possibilities and opportunities for discussion. Here is on the lower left-hand corner, you will see a picture of what turns out to be BP's large refinery next to incredible poverty next door. Lots of things going on. One more slide, beep, I think shows, this is my other favorite, and this is my last. This is an example, again, where technology can have something to say about the total climate change picture. This is a picture of a group of scientists who are meeting at DAISY, which is the Deutsches Research Institution, which does high energy physics, quarks and gluons, and all sorts of good stuff. These folks are getting together to try to persuade their colleagues at DAISY to start a movement to establish in South Africa and, a movement in North Africa and the Middle East, something called MENA, to be sure that those folks develop the strategies for capturing solar energy from none other than the Sahara Desert. That is an enormous challenge, of course. Doing anything with the Sahara Desert is very difficult. It turns out that having the capacity to actually tap into one of the world's largest sources of energy, which is indeed a carbon-neutral source, is something that is quite exciting to the scientific community. And it turns out that by making the Middle East and North African folks the experts, you then are not doing the usual thing of simply coming in and exploiting their futures, but you're actually letting them become the experts and then teaching us how to actually capture energy from the Sahara Desert, something which is an enormous treasure from their point of view. So that's the kind of thinking I'm thinking about. As a climate scientist, I am perhaps more attached to technology and technology issues. So let me shut up and ask, how are you? You're sitting there looking very quiet, and I haven't given you a chance to say anything. So ask your thoughts.
Are you familiar with the cold-blooded campaign in Indiana?
Yes.
Cold-blooded. And look around and see how many people of African descent are in this room. Talk about the NAACP.
This is brilliant. I love it, Harlan. It turns out that we had a march for Coal-Free Indiana is an organization, a student organization on campus that has it is a very lively organization that really cares about the reduction of coal. Indiana University burns coal to heat its buildings. Turns out that the students, appropriately so, also the faculty, have passed resolutions in their legislative bodies saying that Indiana University, as a university, should not invest in carbon fuels. So divestment is on the table, and we are working to try to make that happen. In fact, we just had a march last Thursday, and I went to talk to the president on Tuesday about that possibility, and you're very good to ask. And the president at Indiana University, whose name is Michael McRobbie, was actually not like the people in Congress. He has long since reached the stage where he realizes that climate change is indeed happening and that he, as a leader of a major institution, has to do something about that. So we've passed the point where there is denial, even at university presidents' levels. This is good. So we are making progress from this point of view. It's a brilliant point. Others, yes. Yes, Canada rising, U.S. sinking,
now,
right.
Is that being part of the reason why our estimates or projections about the rising of the ocean is too low because of that sinking?
No, it turns out the ocean rise is done strictly on the basis of worldwide data. So you simply collect data around the world and ask what is happening. Taking into account, you have to take into account the rise and fall of the continents, when you're going to make a projection about sea level rise. Sea level rise data has nothing to do with that. That just means that the people in America are particularly affected, but the answer is that the averages worldwide are reliable, and they're the ones you're seeing. It's about the same as the sinking is about the same rate as the amount of ocean level rise. That is, the ocean level is rising at the moment at something like a millimeter and a half a year, and they're sinking at about another millimeter and a half a year. Yeah, so it's three on the East Coast.
The thing you said about the plate tectonics, does that implicate climate change in earthquakes?
Oh, does that have an effect on earthquakes and so forth? Well, you're out of my knowledge domain. It's a wonderful question, Dan. I have no idea. Do we have an expert?
No, I was going to ask a different question.
Oh, please. No, I put you on the spot.
Sorry. One of the scariest things I think you said, at least personally to me, while you were talking is the thing you said about soil moisture.
Yes.
Especially because as someone from the Midwest who's lived in the Midwest most of my life, I know lots and lots of people who are like, well, you know, climate change is something that's going to be horrible for people in Florida, it's going to be horrible for people in California, but
right.
We've got the Great Lakes right here, we've got plenty of water, we can grow anything we need. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it won't be so bad for us, but it sounds like from what you're saying that with soil moisture as a key component, there's some real, really, really big problems.
There is one other piece of that, and there's the Great Lakes, of course, are changing height as well, actually losing height over the last 10 years or so, another effect of climate change. So there are several reasons to worry about that. I think the other piece of that, which is quite positive, is this. If you think about the agriculturally rich areas of which we are in the middle, that one of the things that makes a great deal of sense is to look at the relative ratio of carbon in the atmosphere compared to carbon in the soil. Turns out the carbon in the soil is much, much larger than the carbon in the atmosphere by several orders of magnitude. So a very positive thing to do, which is a win-win situation, is to make sure that part of climate change is the business of enriching soils. Enriching soils for farmers turns out to be central to the business of sequestering carbon. Yes, you can pull it back out and reuse it, but you want to put it right back in the soil again. So there is this business of making sure that the total carbon is indeed increased in the soil, because the advantage of that is that crops then grow enormously better with that situation. So that is a very good thing for us in the Midwest to keep in mind. Other questions? You are wonderful folks. Yes, there's one. Last question.
Okay, as far as sea level rise is concerned, the Midwest doesn't, at least some of the people that are not as interested as we are,
right,
don't think that a little bit is much of a change.
They're
and
right.
Would you, if you were some of us, would you try to emphasize things like Hurricane Sandy would not have such a great effect on the east coast of the United States, which affects your insurance rates, because everybody nationwide pays more? Or how would you approach that from a Midwestern point of view?
You know, I think I would. That's everything you say is correct. We are all implicated, and we are so highly coupled in the world financially that's what's going on. What I would do, I think, is work best and first on the direct impacts that have to do with the impact on my crops as a local farmer, or as a person who is living in the Midwest who then is going to have to deal then with the enormous fluctuation in intensity of storms and the enormous fluctuation in intensity of drought and flood. The difficulty is not that the total amount of rainfall in the Midwest is changing particularly. It's that we're going through periods where you're going to have summer after summer, which is really dry, and then two summers later, really wet, and neither is appropriate or good for our economy. So I would tend to work more directly on those than I would on the less but extraordinarily important issues that are the financial issues that you mentioned, namely increase in insurance rates and so forth. That's my take, but I don't know that because I'm not an economist. Thank you, lovely folks. You are wonderful, and I just... I'm so grateful.